So the bank has had all excuses. Why they did nothing? Why
yeah,
they did nothing?
We didn't need to do this.
Yeah. And the economists said very little, except for the economists with the 100 reserve plan, which was later, which they presented to Roosevelt. But as this economy was...
Would that have been Irving Fisher?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And over 200 economists signed on to that plan.
Oh.
Yeah, the Chicago plan, they called it, the 100% reserve plan. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Irving Fisher, in October of 1933, Roosevelt had become president in March of 1933, published his book, The Debt Deflation Theory of Great Depressions. He understood about debt and money. We went over that.
That's Harrison. The second governor of the bank. Harrison, you mentioned him.
Yeah, here's the name. George L. Harrison, second governor of the New York Fed Bank. He ended up doing nothing either.
Well, there's a new Harrison that we know.
Yes.
Maybe he'll do something.
Yes. And and then the last thing was talking about Adam Smith's false economic concepts. You know, the invisible hand of the marketplace?
He's on the phone.
There are several studies.
Yes. I love it. There are several spottings of the invisible hand of the market.
There are fingerprints all over everything.
I like the cartoon.
I have the invisible hand of the market online too. Shall I put it through?
Speak louder. Yeah. Okay. So I'm hoping that, I don't know if we should wait 5 minutes and see if Martin can get online.
Yeah, we're waiting for Linnea too.
Yeah. Let's go. Slide
36.
36.
Right there.
Right there. Okay, so we're going to say slideshow from current slide. Okay. Yay. So, Don, why don't you read the third banking crisis?
Okay. Roosevelt closes the banks, the Fed system, and the banking holiday. In the final 2 months prior to the banking holiday, from March 6 to 15 in 1933, there was nothing that could be called a Federal Reserve system policy. The system was demoralized. Each bank was operating on its own. All participated in the general atmosphere of panic that was spreading in the financial community and the community at large. The leadership which an independent central banking system was supposed to give the market were conspicuous by their absence, said Friedman and Swartz, page 391. The state to which open market operations, the most potent tool of the system, had fallen was graphically revealed when, as banking difficulties mounted in February, Harrison, the Fed president in New York, ruled out a meeting of the conference on grounds that it would be difficult, if not impossible, to hold a meeting of the system open market policy conference at this time.
Can you believe that? With everything going on?
Yeah, he's a coward.
No, but for the system to just, they just fall apart. They just said, that's it, no one is trying anything.
They're afraid.
Yeah, but leaders, even when leaders are afraid, they're
supposed
real
leaders.
To.
These guys are just bankers that managed to get the job.
Ay, ay, ay. I'm going to talk about
this. Oh, let's see. That drawing on the left has open market.
Yeah, the open market.
So they're dealing in securities.
Yes.
And on figure three, the Federal Reserve Bank sends the money to the open market committee. FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee.
Right, they're the ones that actually do the buying and selling of the securities in order to create reserves or pull money in.
And enabling the banks to buy the securities, they then can create money.
Yes.
Yeah. So that money is interchanged with corporations and with prime banks, and which also money, the corporations deposit money into the prime banks. Let's see, what are the little thing? Issues new dollars. The corporation issues new dollars.
Well, here's creating inflation. The Fed sells securities.
Yeah.
I mean,
buys them.
Buys securities. And issues new money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And deflation is when the Fed sells securities and pulls in money.
Yeah.
So that's the basic operation. Do you know, I feel like this, the Federal Open Market Committee and its process of buying and selling securities is still very unclear to me.
Well, you're not alone. If that makes you feel any better.
It's just, you know, how do you present that to an ordinary American?
I think one's supposed not to present it to an ordinary American.
Lauren, I think you're right. It just feels so like, like, what does this mean?
Unless I get it in real life that I'm buying or selling a security, I won't know what it is.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't feel it. I've got to do more than just think about it in a written sentence or something.
And even when you as an investor are buying and selling securities, it's not the same. You're not creating money or eliminating money by doing that. You're just moving money around.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing something very different, creating and destroying it.
Years ago, I would invest in municipal bonds. And I knew what they were, sort of, but all I did was invest in them. And then when they paid dividends, place I invested them, I bought them, just bought more bonds with the money that they created, with the money they generated.
With the interest that is created.
So I didn't get to know much about it at all.
That's right. Okay. Next, Will.
Wait a second. Okay. I'm going to get 37. That's the top of the list. Okay, 3/3 banking crisis. Roosevelt closes the bank. One fiction put forward is that Roosevelt's executive order closed many unwilling banks, but most of them had already been closed when he took office. In 1929 alone, 659 banks closed their doors. By 1932, an additional 5,096 banks went out of business. Wow. Families lost their life savings overnight. Their bank was gone. Beginning on February the 14th, 1933, Michigan, which had been hit particularly hard by the Great Depression, declared an 8-day bank holiday. Fears of other bank closures spread from state to state as people rushed to withdraw their money just in case. Within weeks, 36 other states held their own bank holidays in an attempt to stem the bank runs. The banking system seemed to be on the verge of collapse. and that is a Wikipedia article, Emergency Banking Act. And it looks like on the right you've got a bank run, and then you've got jobless men. Keep going, we can't take care of our own.
God.
Chamber of Commerce. My goodness. Keep going. Oh, the Chamber of Commerce just tell them to keep going. They don't want them around. Okay. Then you've got a graph from 1921 to 1933, commercial bank suspensions.
Friend of the force.
And there they all are, 506 of 21, 366 of 22, 646 of 23, just on and on. Okay, now, losses of depositors, I guess that's 57 million? Is that what that is? The first one, the 21?
They're in thousands.
They're in thousands, so.
Yeah, 7,000 thousands.
So, that would be 173 million, right?
Of which one? That's 57.
Deposits. I was losing a lot of deposits. 173
million.
Yeah.
Well, what about the losses of deposits? How do you read that?
57
that's in
million.
Thousand. Yeah, that's in thousands. So it's
57 million?
Yeah.
Okay. And it goes down to 1933, where there's $540 million losses in deposits. People's savings, people's money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, $500 million.
And, I mean, you see, there were closings in the 20s, right?
Yeah.
But it really got bad when the bank, you know, you really had the money supply affected in 1930 on. Let me go get that. The third banking crisis, which was in 1933, the very beginning of 1933. And basically, in February, Michigan declared an eight-day bank holiday because people were running to get money out of the banks and the banks were folding.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, fears of other bank closures spread from state to state, so that within weeks, February and March, within weeks, 36 other states held their own bank holidays. Yeah, it's pretty impressive. And this is Roosevelt's coming into office the beginning of March.
Mm-hmm.
He starts. You know, I mean, and the other thing that we were discussing was the fact that during the end of 1932 and the beginning of 1933, the bankers at the Federal Reserve level, at that high level, did nothing. They were demoralized. They couldn't even hold a committee meeting. I mean, that's pretty scary. You know,
yeah,
it's pretty scary. Yeah, leaders can be scared, but they have to lead.
That's right.
Yeah,
you know,
to do something. You can't just sit. Yeah.
These
yeah.
guys are like bureaucrats more than leaders.
I don't know. I wonder if any of them did their memoirs later in life and said anything about this period. You know, honestly. Okay, so.
Well, hey, this is Will Decker in Oklahoma, the still pitcher. I want you to know your dad is a hero. Yeah, if he hadn't taken some literature down to the Occupy Wall Street Library, the Occupy the NEDAC would not exist. Harrison found the flyer. And subsequently said, well, he right then he looked at it and said, hell yeah, this is it. This is what we want to do, and this is the future, and created Occupy the Need Act. Yeah.
Wow.
So if your dad hadn't done that, it would not exist.
Oh.
A whole important leg of this monetary movement.
Thank you. That's nice.
It would have just been a one-legged movement. Yeah.
We had me on live here a while ago with audio, with video, but it
would have
work.
To hop along.
We failed it some way.
So, why don't you read that?
This is the next slide?
Yeah, the next one.
Okay, at 1 a.m. on Monday, March 6, President Roosevelt issued Proclamation 2039, ordering the suspension of all banking transactions effective immediately. He had taken the oath of office only 36 hours earlier. Banking institutions included all Federal Reserve banks, national banking associations, banks, trust companies, savings banks, building and loan associations, credit unions, or other corporations, partnerships, associations, or persons engaged in the business of receiving deposits, making loans, discounting business paper, or transacting any other form of banking business.
Counterfeits, welcome too.
Banking transactions included those dealing with gold or silver coin or bullion or currency, and those that pay out deposits, make loans or discounts, deal in foreign exchange, transfer credits from the U.S. to any place abroad, or transact any other banking business whatsoever. So he decided, he made a move to stop all of the, okay.
Yeah.
I see.
And that's
criminal penalties for violation of this executive order are $10,000 fine or 10 years imprisonment or both. That's pretty hefty. Wow. Thank you so much.
I need some crackers. Don, there's some crackers here if you're hungry.
Thanks so much, sir. It's really sweet.
Okay. Don?
Yes.
There's some crackers.
Oh, great.
Okay, so Martin, you're next.
Okay. Okay. Continuing on the third banking crisis.
I just read that.
Oh, okay.
Congress passes the Emergency Banking Act of March 9th, 1933. Title 1, to close banks during the emergency period, extended to March 15th. This act empowered the president to regulate or prohibit the payment of deposits by all banking institutions. Title 2, to reorganize the failing banks, gave the controllers of the currency the power to restrict the operations of national banks with impaired assets and to appoint a conservator. Title 3, to strengthen the national banks, empowered the RFC to either buy the stock of national banks or grant loans with the bank stock as collateral. And then Title 4, emergency issue of Federal Reserve notes, gave the Federal Reserve banks the power to issue emergency currency backed by any asset of a commercial bank. Over 200 million of Federal Reserve banknotes were issued in 1933. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Huh. And over on the right, it looks as though we have Franklin Roosevelt signs the Emergency Banking Act 1933, March 9th.
Yeah.
And the photo looks a little overexposed.
Well, this is quite a time. Oh my goodness. But he came in and he
moved.
He moved.
Showed action.
Yes.
Not even if he was didn't know what the hell he was doing, he had guts to go out there and do something.
Yeah, you have to do something.
That's why he was elected 4 times.
Linnea.
Okay, on the Sunday evening before the banks reopened, Roosevelt addressed the nation through one of his signature fireside chats. With honest words and soothing tones, the president assured 60 million radio listeners that the crisis was over and the nation's banks were secure. On the first day back in business, deposits exceeded withdrawals. Wow. By the beginning of April, Americans confidently returned $1 billion to the banking system, and the bank crisis was over. A description of banking from Roosevelt's first fireside chat. Is this true? First of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in many different forms of credit, in bonds, in commercial paper, in mortgages, and in many other kinds of loans. In other words, the bank puts your money to work to keep the wheels of industry and of agriculture turning around.
that's not right.
That's not true.
That's not right.
Yeah, he told a white lie in order to get them to move.
He wasn't a revolutionary.
No.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
He was afraid that the capitalist system was going to fail, and that people would all turn to follow Russia if they didn't do something about it. So he lied his way through.
Yeah. I'll do the next one. Number 4, Keynes to the rescue with a question mark. In December 1933, English economist John Maynard Keynes wrote an open letter to President Roosevelt in the New York Times. And that's Keynes on the left. Mm-hmm. Honorable Franklin D. Roosevelt, an enclosed letter to President Roosevelt by John Maynard Keynes. Dear Mr.
An open letter.
Oh, an open letter.
Yeah.
Dear Mr. President, you have made yourself the trustee for those in every country who seek to mend the evils of our condition by reasoned experiment within the framework of the existing social system. Reason why I should venture to lay my reflections before you. With great respect, your obedient servant, J.M. Keynes.
Wow, obedient servant. So where's the letter? What were the opinions? What did he say he was going to do?
Okay, so there's another couple of slides. Okay, Don, do the next one.
Keynes advised Roosevelt that only expenditures of public authority could bring recovery. That was obvious enough. It shows a picture of how they got a tent up, or I don't know what that is. Some kind of a shelter, maybe the back of a truck.
People living in a tent.
I guess it's a tent. And lots of locks and things and chain link fences. And
bank runs?
It's a bank run.
The bankers weren't doing anything.
The food line on the city street, a rainy day, with the rain reflecting the line.
The Federal Reserve system wasn't creating any money. The money was going down and down and down. Someone had to do something. That was Stephen's remark.
We
that
have nothing to
enough.
Fear but fear itself. His famous slogan.
Right. Do the next one, Don.
Keynes warned Roosevelt to borrow the money. Borrow the That's the problem. I lay overwhelming emphasis on the increase of national purchasing power resulting from governmental expenditure, which is financed by loans. Nothing else counts in comparison with this. I don't know. And then Keynes said, or vice versa, in the past, Orthodox finance has regarded a war as the only legitimate excuse for creating employment by governmental expenditure, borrow money. You, Mr. President, having cast off such fetters, are free to engage in the interests of peace and prosperity, he told FDR.
Oh, so that's why he started all the Social Security program.
He did a lot of things.
Yeah, he did a lot.
So he was kind of being advised.
But it was all by borrowed money. There's no revolutionary new system presented here.
They weren't using sovereign money.
No.
Yeah.
But do you think that he had a vested interest in protecting the Federal Reserve board members?
Yeah, he wanted to keep the capitalist system going the way it was.
But for personal gain or just
because
he was scared?
Are you talking about Roosevelt?
I think he felt a little threatened by the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and he was afraid that it might go that way if they couldn't handle it. I may have got that idea from things I read. I don't remember where I got that idea.
I read somewhere that he comes from a banking family.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there are many people.
So there's a conflict.
Descended from the Dutch settlers. Yeah.
Plymouth Rock?
Roosevelt means Redfield.
And what's that mean?
Redfield is the name of a Dutchman.
Oh, it is? Okay.
No, Roosevelt is the name.
Oh, okay. We'll do the next couple ones.
Okay. Keynes warned Roosevelt not to create the money. Some people may seem to infer that this, from this, that output and income can be raised by increasing the quantity of money. But this is like trying to get fat by buying a larger belt.
Oh, boy.
In the United States today, your belt is plenty big enough for your belly.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's Keynes saying that?
Yes. These are all from this letter. Letter on the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What a bastard. Okay. Well, I'm going to number 45. Keynes attempted to influence Roosevelt to drop his program of necessary reforms, the New Deal. Oh, wow. Now, I'm not clear if the order of urgency between measures of recovery and measures of reform has been duly observed. I cannot detect any material aid to recovery in the National Industrial Reorganization Act. Is that what that's called? NIRA? National Industrial Recovery Act. This is my first reflection that the National Industrial Recovery Act, which is essentially reform and probably impedes recovery, has been put across too hastily in the false guise of being part of the technique of recovery. End quote. The NIRA called on private businesses organized in trade associations to propose industrial codes of fair competition for their industry. During the 2 years of the program's existence, more than 500 codes were enacted. The standard code contained wage and hour provisions.
Yeah.
You've got a symbol of the NRA over there on the right with a worker, it looks like. Oh, it's Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes.
Yeah, she was very active in the in government affairs. The only wife of a president that was like that.
Right. Yeah.
So,
Martin, do the next couple ones.
Okay. Keynes was therefore not a revolutionary, except in relation to the utter backwardness of the financial establishment and their economists. That's Stephen Zelenga from the Lost Science of Money, page 555. Yes, it's rather bleak. Okay, Stephen Zelenga again, Lost Science of Money, page 555. He did not come close to a real solution. That would have been another issue of greenbacks through which the government would have taken back the money power from those who had abused it.
Okay.
And over there at the bottom left, we have a picture of Lincoln, put forth the American greenback, and we have a greenback over there on the right, both sides of it, the front and the back.
I wonder if there was... Well, there was. You'll see later on. There were people talking about the government issuing greenbacks, debt-free money, direct from the government, into circulation. You'll see. It was still around, but definitely not in Roosevelt or Keynes.
Bag of tricks.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, Keynes to the rescue. The debate over Keynesianism is another false monetary debate. The real question has always been whether the nation's money should be created under law by government or under the private caprice of bankers. Stephen Zelenga again, Lost Science of Money again, page 555. And we have some arrows there in the middle bottom, private or public. Basically, Wall Street versus the Treasury, essentially. Who do we want printing money?
And the Congress would be the one deciding how much to issue and for what purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this is the bottom line, that the AMI and Positive Money are trying to make the title of their of what's going on in monetary reform, is that this, we need publicly issued money. We don't need private credit under no public control. Or even under public control, we don't need private credit. We need money. Yeah. Linnea.
Financial losses, the wreckage of the economy. Bank failures were the main cause of the decline in the money stock this brought on the Great Depression. The losses of depositors of the 9,000 American banks that suspended operations during the 4 years from 30 to 33 were $2.5 billion, Terlinga writes. This was the cause of the decline of money stock and thus the cause of the Great Depression. Though losses on stocks were 34 times the losses on bank deposits, it was the banking and money system that had caused the debacle. But the financial losses can't measure the full cost of the lives damaged or destroyed in the Depression. And then on the left, commercial bank suspensions in 30 were 1,350 suspensions. 31 saw 2,293. 31 again?
So, I bet, that's supposed to be 32.
Sorry. Yeah. And then 1,453 and 32. So basically a total of like 10,000.
Yeah, this is the cause of the Great Depression, not the crash.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
But couldn't you argue that the crash actually caused the banks to go bankrupt because there were so many stocks being bought on margin at the time?
Yeah, it was a trigger.
It was a trigger for the banks going bust.
Yeah.
Which then took money out of circulation.
Right, but those banks could have been supported by their Federal Reserve Bank.
Oh yeah, agreed. But
remember last, I'm going to go back page up. I'm going to go back to the slide from, let me go back to it, that showed Irving Fisher's analysis of the depression, the debt depression cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And you get over indebtedness, and then you get something like the crash, where all the debtors are trying to sell off their assets, and the prices are going down, right? And the money stock is contracting. But if you stop there and you give those banks money, so the depositors don't get scared that they're going to lose their deposits, right? And you help those banks, right? Then you can keep the prices of things from falling. Because once the prices started falling, then the producers can't make a profit. And they start laying people off and all that. So he saw it as two separate incidents. One is suddenly all of the indebtedness is at risk and people panic, but you could stop it. But in the Great Depression, the banking system didn't stop it. They did not. They really did very, very little. I think at the very beginning, right after the crash, the New York Bank did put some money out there. But then after that first response, even the New York Federal Reserve Bank let itself be stopped by the reaction of the board and the other banks.
Mm-hmm. Well, this time the Fed did what it didn't do during the crash and the Great Depression.
You mean in 2008?
Yeah.
Yeah. What did Bernanke do? He created $16 trillion of short-term loans. Sent it all around the world.
It's unheard of.
To keep the system afloat, you know. He wrote, I haven't read it, but Bernanke wrote his PhD thesis on the Great Depression. And I read somewhere that he understood you had to do something as part of the Federal Reserve, and he definitely did something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, going back to Keynes. Linnea.
I think this is the one I just read.
Oh, did you just read this?
Yeah,
oh, okay. You just did this?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, so I'll do the next one.
Okay.
Financial losses, the wreckage of the economy. In less than two decades under the Federal Reserve System, 5,096 banks went bankrupt. 88% of them had less than $100,000 capital. 94% of them were in the South, the Midwest, and the West, and they took the nation down with them. So, this is just showing how awful the state of the United States became. The national income from 1929 to 1932 went down 52%. The industrial production went down 47%. I mean, it was just drying up. The DJ industrial average was reduced 89%. Wholesale price index fell 32%. Unemployment increased 326%. And the value of international trade went down 63%. I mean, it was just, it's pretty incredible figures.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
Don, do the next one.
Roosevelt began direct relief programs. Oh, yeah. FERA, I don't know what that means.
That's the name of one of them. It'll explain it later.
And started work programs. The CWA, the WPA, I remember that. That hired people to build roads, dams, national parks, and other projects. The New Deal expenditures based on government borrowing would benefit the bankers, but some of the money would also build real infrastructure. Under a government money system, the U.S. could have created the money itself and not been saddled with debt. However, the country was so starved for money, this small government deficit helped. Harry Hopkins wrote, "Long after the workers of the CWA are dead and gone, and these hard times forgotten, their effort will be remembered by permanent useful works in every county of every state. People will ride over bridges they made, travel on their highways, attend schools they built, navigate waterways that they improved, do their public businesses in courthouses and state capitals, which workers from the sea WA rescued from despair."
Who's Harry Hopkins?
I forget now. The name is familiar, but
he was an economic. He worked with Roosevelt. He's Roosevelt's economic advisor, right?
Yeah, he was kind of his right hand man, Harry Hopkins.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's what I remember. Yeah. So.
Now the WPA, you talk about counterfeiting the greenbacks. They counterfeited sidewalks around our town, Martin. They weren't WPA sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
Who built them?
Yeah. You know, if you've seen the WPA on sidewalks, did they have them around New York City?
I don't remember ever seeing
them. Is that the Waterworks? What's the WPA?
Works Project Administration.
They built a dam up in upstate New York, near where my grandparents had a little farm. I remember going up there after working on the farm. Each day we'd go up to the CW, I can't remember. It was a different title than one of these ones. and go swimming up there and bring soap and everything to wash ourselves and stuff like that.
In Oklahoma, they built football stadiums that were later used to store German prisoners.
My God!
Good use out of them.
No, they also built a road up Mount Scott too. This is the highest point in Oklahoma, up off the Panhandle.
Yeah, my father took me to one of the places where they had German prisoners.
My God. I've gone hiking in New York State, and I pass structures that they built.
Yeah.
From the Depression. They have little plaques on it.
Yeah, they're still around. Will be forever.
And you can see the pictures of people put to work.
That's right.
Building roads and...
Yeah, we got wheelbarrows.
Fixing this bridge in Denver.
Doing everything by hand with wheelbarrows.
And here it says, CWA helps Nebraska to 5 new libraries.
Yeah.
So I guess the old one's at the bottom and the new one's at the top.
I don't understand the last sentence in the first paragraph. The small government deficit helped?
Oh, the government was always borrowing.
Oh, right.
In order to have money to for the New Deal.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this was borrowed money, not sovereign money.
Yeah. We'll do the next one.
Okay. Let's see what happened. The following New Deal, that starts, the following New Deal priorities spent $15.5 million between 1933 and 1940, only 6 of the financial losses of the Depression. It's all it was, okay. Roosevelt was blocked, this is Zarlinga, Roosevelt was blocked by conservatives worried about inflation in the middle of the Great Depression. Yeah. The financial establishment finally allowed the creation of bank credit. And if the the new products of industry could be blown up, swell, not increasing the nation's wealth and the channel of build stuff that would blow up and sink. Zarlinga, page 557. Okay. Now that you've got the total costs, RFC, Reconstruction Finance Corporation, set up by Hoover, loaned $3 billion to distressed financial institutions. Total cost, $283 million. The FERA, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, made grants to states and local governments for direct relief of $34 per family per month. There you go, look at that. 1933 to 1935, they put out $3.1 billion. CWA, Civil Works Administration, for work programs to create manual labor constructing and repairing bridge buildings and bridges, November 33 to March of 34. So it was less than a year.
Oh yeah.
No, yeah.
Oh, it was okay. It was only 5 months.
Yeah, $818 million. And then the WPA, Works Progress Administration, paid $80 per month per person employed. $2 million annually.
No, employed 2 million people annually.
Oh, 2 million. Yeah, I got dollars on my
list.
2 million annually people. Okay, it tried to provide one paid job for all families in which the breadwinner suffered long-term unemployment. And they did $8.12 billion. WPA. I think my dad worked in a CWA project because he was like, they said he was there and then he wasn't there very long. So, and that's why it was only, it was 5 months.
Ah.
Yeah.
Huh. Martin, do the next one.
Okay, the farmer's debt trap. A rise in commodity prices from 1914 to 1920 had enticed farmers into too much debt. I think that's because a lot of agricultural land was taken out of production because of World War I in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah. From 1920, farm income and value dropped dramatically. But debt, interest payments, and taxes remained high. The farmers were caught in a debt trap. Okay, let's take a look at this. The first column is years, 1920, 1923, 1925, 1930, 1933, and then the second column is average farm value. So in 1920, it was $10,295. 1923, it had dropped to $8,107. By 1925, it had dropped to $7,764. By 1930, $7,524. And by 1933, less than half what it was worth in 1920, $4,569. So that went down. Also, net income went down.
Way down. Look at that.
Way down. It went from 1,199 down to $304 in 1933. That's almost a factor of a quarter, basically. You're just not killing it. Yeah. Total debt miserably started off at 8,448 and basically ended up in 1933 at 8,466. So total debt stayed up.
Income down, debt stayed the same.
Wow.
Yeah, and in between, it actually gone up, unfortunately. Mortgage interest was $574 in 1920, was $472 in 1933. It hadn't come down very much at all.
Against a net income of $304.
Yeah, right.
Wow. Oh my gosh, yeah. Look at that.
Yeah.
Oh, and don't forget taxes. We've got taxes per farm, which started out at $483, rose a bit in the intervening years, and in 1933 would actually drop down to $398. So that hadn't budged very much at all. But the net income had plummeted and farm value had plummeted. So farmers were absolutely hammered.
Wow. Hammered is a good word.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Linnea.
The 35 to 33 Resettlement Administration relocated struggling urban and rural families to communities planned by the federal government. It built relief camps in California for migratory workers, especially refugees from the drought-struck Dust Bowl of the Southwest. And then there are some pictures.
It says, Resettlement Administration is putting land back to its proper use, trying to create, you know, arable land again.
And trying to stop dust storms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had to plant trees for that, didn't they, Martin?
I've heard that they did.
Yeah, they planted the cypress tree, or the the cedar trees, and we have a hell of a problem with that.
Yeah, hay fever.
And covering good land. It's incredible, these stem trees and concrete.
Yeah, but you need them to stop the dust.
No good. You can't use lumber for anything. You can't. Nothing.
You're going to have erosion if you don't find some way to stop the wind from blowing all the topsoil away.
Yeah, they did that. Now they cause it a problem.
Yeah, I was in on a Greek island once, and they had taken all of the trees and bushes, just stripped the land around this restaurant that was out on a promontory, you know. And you walked out of the restaurant, and all the dust was going in your face. It was just dust blowing around because there was nothing to hold the earth.
Yeah, after a while, it was down to rock. Bare rock.
That's right. No more dust, just rock.
Yeah. I think it was deforestation that took out the civilization on Easter Island.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Wow, that is really interesting.
And there's a picture of a mule and a plow. Small loans give farmers a new start. Resettlement Administration. And this sign here, 4 miles to Pender...
CCC.
Pendalea Farms.
Civilian Construction Corps.
America's first farm city. A farm settlement project, Resettlement Administration. And they try to help the farmer, poor farmer.
Well, a lot of the farmers here in Oklahoma live in town. They live in the little towns and then they farm outside their farms, their acreages are outside of town.
Oh, that's interesting. When did they start to do that?
I have no idea, but they did that.
Hmm. I'll do the next one. Roosevelt's programs to help farmers. Bankhead Jones Farm Tenant Act of 1937. Supervised credit of $2 billion offered to bankrupt farmers. Modest credit to assist tenant farmers to purchase land. They wanted the tenant farmers who didn't own land to purchase some land. So here was the terms of the loan. Section 3A, loans made under this title shall be in such amount, not in excess of the amount certified by the county committee to be the value of the farm, as may be necessary to enable the borrower to acquire the farm and for necessary repairs and improvements thereon, and shall be secured by a first mortgage or deed of trust on the farm. The instruments under which the loan is made and security given therefore shall, 1, provide for the repayment of the loan within an agreed period of not more than 40 years from the making of the loan.
Wow. That's pretty fair.
Yeah. And 2, I know, provide for the payment of interest on the unpaid balance of the loan
3%.
At the rate of 3% per annum. So that helped the tenant farmers.
And they're making $304 a year.
Yeah.
Sounds like this was done for the bankers. A banker designed this program.
I think he's paying more in interest than the loan.
Yeah, they're loaning these
years,
people this stuff, and then they're going to take their farm. They're going to get the land.
Hmm.
This wasn't too good an idea.
To make it a loan, you mean?
Yeah, they're giving them loans. And then you give them land, money, period.
Exactly.
Buying tractors.
I might have done it with a loan with no interest. Maybe that they could have handled that.
That's right. That's
maybe.
True.
Yeah.
They must, you know, but there's all this kind of Calvinist private property.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, you know, by the sweat of your brow, earn every little dollar, or it's immoral, you know. Crazy. It's a crazy way of thinking. Mine, you know.
So my idea was too far off. When I had an iron foundry, and the environmentalists made me invest in new electric furnaces, and I had to borrow $1 million, my idea was... They want me to clean up the air out and damn well buy me the equipment to do it with and give it to me. That's what sovereign money's all about and things. We do that direct. We don't just loan people money. Because guess who ended up running the foundry? The banker. It took a while, but that's exactly what happened.
I see.
Right.
Yeah.
Debt as a weapon.
Yeah.
Don, do the next one.
At least the government acted. The money power should always reside in the government. The cause of the Great Depression was monetary, and its solution needed to be monetary. Because monetary control was exercised by the private Federal Reserve System, the government had to borrow money created by the Federal Reserve System to pay for its programs instead of creating money itself. But at least the government acted. FDR's New Deal consisted of relief, reform, and recovery. Many of his programs combined elements of all three.
I wish there had been more reform.
Is that Roosevelt on the extreme right?
Yes.
He's in a car, yeah, that makes sense.
That's him, and that's him.
He was crippled, you know. The drawing on the left is industry in general, I guess.
That's by...
It was done by an artist during the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And he was... he got money through one of these New Deal programs.
Oh, yeah, I've seen something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're on walls and things.
Yeah. Will, do the next one.
Oh, yeah, the artists, or WPA workers. Okay, why monetary power should always reside in the government, an example from 1932. In 1932, with the state of credit and banks deteriorating, the private Federal Reserve System began to speak of buying securities through the open market purchase program. This would create bank reserves. Approval of buying $25 million a week was authorized by the Open Market Policy Conference. This was indeed modest. The modest program would very likely have been expanded into a major one, or perhaps even carried out, if it had not been for direct and indirect pressure from Congress. Harrison, President of New York Fed, that we've already talked about, told the executive committee of its directors on April 4th that apparently the only way to forestall some sort of radical financing legislation by Congress is to go further and faster with their own program.
So in other words, the Federal Reserve got scared that the government
is going to do it instead.
Yeah. Was going to, you know, pass a law to, you know, maybe take some of the power over to the government. So it pushed them to finally do something very modest. And this is in 32, right?
Yeah. Okay, Governor Meyer of the Federal Reserve Board called attention merely as a matter of information to the fact that a resolution had been offered in the Senate asking the Federal Reserve Board to state its program. He believed that the time had come when the system might be expected to use its powers more fully in an effort to stop the credit decline. After the initial program was voted on April the 12th, 1932, the system bought $100 million in government securities per week for five weeks. Freed from congressional pressure, Congress adjourned on July the 16th. The conference lapsed into its earlier pattern. The program adopted was a minimum face-saving program and was carried out at nearly the minimum level consistent with the letter of recommendation. This is from Friedman and Swartz, page 384 to 385. They were under pressure, and then as soon as Congress was gone, they went back to the old ways.
That's right. Doing nothing.
Yeah.
I just find it incredible.
Yeah.
Martin, do the next one.
Okay. Another greenback is needed. Economists were unaware of the history of greenback debt-free money, and most probably still are. Okay. John Maynard Keynes had a small excuse for his ignorance of government money. England had hardly any history of it since 1694. Sorry. But then we have, the United States. Because of the purposeful neglect of the historical study of economics and economic thought, most of them were and still are as ignorant of the history of the greenbacks as the English economists are. That's again Stephen Zelenga, Lost Science of Money, page 560. And there we have a cartoon over there. It says Economics 2014. And it shows a young guy in bed and a young lassie coming out of what looks like the bathroom. Okay, I've done the numbers. We can afford a baby or a BMW, not both.
This is how economists think.
Yeah.
Baby or BMW?
Hmm? What'd you say, Will?
Baby or BMW?
That's right. Oh, my goodness.
That reminds me of a movie I saw where the little guy's big brothers were having a party at the house, and one of the real pretty girls sat down by him, and he was trying to smoke a cigar, the kid was, about 14. And the girl says, "It's me or the cigar?" And the kid thought about it a little bit and said, "The cigar."
Linnea, to the next one.
Okay. The Chicago plan was a banking reform for full reserve banking.
Read the title.
But not all American economists were ignorant.
Yeah.
The University of Chicago economists in the wake of the Great Depression suggested this. A 6-page memorandum was given, limited and confidential distribution to about 40 individuals on March 16th of 1933. It was also given to President Roosevelt as a way to reform the fractional reserve system with full reserves, doing away with private debt money creation. The plan was supported by such notable economists as Frank Knight, Lloyd Mintz, Henry Schultz, Henry Simons, Paul Douglas, and more. Roosevelt chose to stay with the unstable fractional system. Full reserve banks are required to keep the full amount of each depositor's funds in cash, ready for immediate withdrawal or on demand. And Michael Kumhoff says, under the present system, banks do not have to wait for depositors to appear and make funds available before they can on-lend or intermediate those funds. Rather, they create their own funds deposits in the act of lending. This fact can be verified in the description of the money creation system in many central bank statements, and it is obvious to anybody who has ever lent money and created the resulting book entries. Today's plan for full reserve banking, the Chicago Plan Revisited, an IMF report, oh, this is where it came from 2012.
Yeah.
I see, it's by Benz and Kumhoff.
Yeah, he took this plan, the Chicago Plan from the Great Depression, which people don't know about, and he works, he's an economist at the IMF, and he wrote this paper analyzing the Chicago Plan and saying it would work and that it's better. And he took, I think, a very brave step coming publicly out.
And that was mm-hmm. 2 years ago? Probably 3 years ago
three
now?
3 years ago, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's gone. He's come a couple years, 2 or 3 years, to the AMI conference out in Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah. He came in 1912, I think, when it was first issued, and talked about it uh-huh. to the conference. Yeah. So I think he's brave. Brave guy. Oh, and that's the end of the third banking crisis, and...
Did they all shut down?
No, there's a part three.
Oh.
Great, yeah.
Okay, so go to the one that says parts of presentation.
I'm still not on my screen yet, but it's coming. There we go.
Okay.
And it's got 32 screens. Wow.
We don't have to finish this today at all.
Oh, okay. You're back to that green photo?
Yes. Just go past everything till you get to the table of contents.
Okay, I'm there. Parts of the presentation.
Okay, Martin, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
Okay. So we have a slide about McFadden, who charges the Federal Reserve with treason from our Congress. Changes in the law, and this is about banking, gold, and securities. There are a lot of changes in the New Deal. The Social Security Act, historical collapse of the gold-silver ratio, the silver purchase program, sort of another another point about commodity money. The silver supply finally starts, the money supply finally starts increasing, and then one more insult from the Fed that stopped the recovery again in 1937. Unbelievable. Six, how easy it is to create money financing World War II.
Yeah.
No problem creating money for war. No problem. And the aftermath, the propaganda to resurrect capitalism moral standing, which we have today, thrown at us, and then the Catholic reaction and the Church of England reaction, which I think are very, very interesting. So I'll do this one about McFadden. McFadden charges the Federal Reserve of treason. May 23, 1933, Representative McFadden presented a list of charges against the Federal Reserve Board and bank officers asking for an investigation and their impeachment. The last charge was, quote, whereas I charge them jointly and severally with the crime of having treasonably conspired and acted against the peace and security of the United States, and with having treasonably conspired to destroy constitutional government in the United States. President Jackson and his aide had called them a den of vipers. He called it a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. He saw it as that.
Yeah.
And this is his picture.
I believe it.
When the Federal Reserve Act was passed, this is McFadden talking. When the Federal Reserve Act was passed, the people of these United States did not perceive that a world banking system was being set up here, a super state controlled by international bankers and industrialists, acting together to enslave the world. Every effort has been made by the Fed to conceal its powers, but the truth is, the Fed has usurped the government, which is what we know today, right?
Yeah, that's what I was saying about Obama as a treasonous when he urges the people to pass the TPP program, where the tribunals have more power than the courts of this country.
Right. And it says here, after he lost his congressional seat in 1934, like Kucinich, speaking out, he remained in the public eye as a vigorous opponent of the financial system. That is until his sudden death on October 3rd, 1936, of a dose of intestinal flu after attending a banquet in New York City. There were two previous attempts on Lewis McFadden's life. Two bullets were fired at him on one occasion, and later he was poisoned at a banquet, which he survived because the doctor was at the banquet and got rid of whatever was in his stomach.
Okay.
Now, those bankers play for blood.
This man was so outspoken, and he says, this is a conspiracy. It's not, you know, they're not incompetent. There's something else going on with his message, you know. Don, do the next one.
The Thomas Amendment, changes in the law, banking law. The Thomas Amendment, legalized issuance of greenbacks, Title III, Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933. The Thomas Amendment stated that whenever the president desired currency expansion, he first must authorize the Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve to purchase up to $3 billion of federal obligations. Should open market operations prove insufficient, the president has several options. He could have the U.S. Treasury issue up to $3 billion in greenbacks.
Yeah.
Reduce the gold content of the dollar by as much as 50%, or accept $100 million in silver at a price not to exceed 50 cents per ounce in payment of World War I debts owed by European nations. I'm at a loss what that means.
So, if the Federal Reserve wasn't going to create money needed, then the president was either going to ask Congress to issue greenbacks, debt-free money, to make more money, or he'd reduce the gold content, so instead of having so many coins of gold, you have twice as much, which would increase the money supply, right?
Okay.
And buy silver, and issue silver certificates, which would increase the money supply. They're like paper money.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Federal Reserve didn't act, the president was going to do this
mm-hmm.
and create treasury money.
In one way or another, one of these ways.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So that's the Thomas Amendment in the Encyclopedia. He was an Oklahoma senator. If the secretary, when directed by the president, is unable to secure the assent of the several Federal Reserve banks and the Federal Reserve Board to direct the Secretary of the Treasury to cause to be issued in such amount or amounts as he may from time to time order U.S. notes as provided in the Act approved in February of 1862.
That's great. Lincoln's greenbacks.
Oh, yeah.
That's the actual war, and that's what they were pointing to.
There's a picture of him there. There's a tall guy with white hair?
Yeah, that's Thomas.
Elmer Thomas, Oklahoma senator. From 27 to 51, that's a long run.
Yeah, yeah. And Stephen says in his book that this Thomas Amendment is really legalizes, again, the greenback. You know, it's part of the law that they can be issued by the Treasury.
Now.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there was some debate about using that just a few years back when the Republicans had closed down the government. There was some talk about the government actually issuing basically these greenbacks to actually pay federal workers and things.
Oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I'm glad that got talked about.
But
that's
it. It didn't happen.
Just talking about it, just having it out in, you know, in the consciousness of the public.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm going to more explore who Elmer Thomas was. This would be interesting. See where he was from, how he was done. I'll look him up.
Okay. We'll do the next one.
Since we're Oklahomans, we need to know about him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, that's true. Oklahoma.
Now, the Banking Act of 1933, is that what I'm supposed to be on?
Yeah.
An act to provide for the safer and more efficient use of the assets of banks, to prevent the undue diversion of funds in the speculative operations and for other purposes.
Hmm.
Now, we have the Banking Act of 1933, Section 7. The Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. could regulate margin requirements on stocks. On affirmative vote of not less than six of its members, the Federal Reserve Board shall have power to fix from time to time for each Federal Reserve District the percentage of individual bank capital and surplus that may be represented by loans secured by stock or bond collateral made by member banks within such district, with a view to preventing the undue use of bank loans for the speculative carrying of securities. Okay.
Right, so in 1929, leading up to 1929, brokers and banks were lending 90% of the value of a security to people buying those securities.
Yeah.
So the margin is what the borrower has to come up with his own money. So the margin back then was 10%, and all this debt was created. So here they're saying the Federal Reserve Board is now given the power to set that margin requirement. I think now it might be like 50% or something like that. But back in the 20s, it was 10%. I could give my broker or my bank $10 and they'd give me a $90 loan mm-hmm. and I could buy something for $100.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. The board's power over reserve requirements, rediscount rates, and market operations was increased. The open market committee was created, according to Zarlinga, page 561. There is hereby created a Federal Open Market Committee.
which shall consist of as many members as there are Federal Reserve districts. Each Federal Reserve Bank, by its board of directors, shall annually select one member of said committee. That's the Banking Act of 1933, Section 8. The committee could inject new money into the economy by creating money to purchase government bonds. It could remove money by selling its bonds.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's real power they have, this open market operations of, you know.
Okay. The board's power over foreign banking was secured. The Federal Reserve Board shall exercise special supervision over all relationships and transactions of any kind entered into by any Federal Reserve Bank with any foreign bank or banker, or with any group of foreign banks or bankers, and all such relationships and transactions shall be subject to such regulations, conditions, and limitations as the board may prescribe. That's Banking Act of 33, Section 10. And the next time you travel, try the train, relax, and it shows two guys carrying their bags alongside the highway. They weren't going to be taking a train.
You know, when I read about the powers that are given in the Banking Act to the Federal Reserve, this is where I start feeling like there's something else going on than just this just happened because the system wasn't watching or wasn't caring enough. Because they're ending up with more power, and they're the ones that caused the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So then I start to think maybe McFadden is right, that there's some kind of conspiracy, mm-hmm. some kind of plan. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And like you said yesterday, you said, cause a crisis in order to get more power.
Yeah.
They're ending up with more power.
So, cause the Depression, more power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Martin, do the next one.
Okay, restructuring the Federal Reserve. Again, this is the 1935 Banking Act. It dissolved the old Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. and replaced it with a 7-member Board of Governors appointed by the President for 14 terms.
14-year terms.
14-year terms, right.
That's funny.
Wow, okay. The Board of Governors became increasingly independent from the executive branch of the federal government.
I didn't know that.
The Treasury Secretary and the Comptroller of the Currency were no longer on the board.
They were on the board.
Yeah, they were. Mm-hmm. Now they're taking them away.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy.
It created the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, and organized the Fed Bank of New York to purchase and or sell U.S. government securities in the open market in order to determine the stock of money in the U.S.
So they gave the power basically to the New York Fed, centralized the most important power that the Federal Reserve has into this major Wall Street-centered bank, international bank.
And also the board's powers were greatly increased and included the power to regulate margin requirements on stocks, power over reserve requirements, rediscount rates and market operations, power to appoint the presidents of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks, power to regulate the Federal Reserve Banks and foreclose their credit if they did not comply. Oh wow, that is a real centralization of power.
And that's in the board in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But the board doesn't have the money. The board can't make money. Only the banks can make the money.
Right.
You know.
the Federal Reserve moved its meetings from the Treasury Department to a new building constructed on Constitution Avenue. And I've seen pictures of Occupy the Need Act outside there, I believe.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, that's where I first saw Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. And they got a new building.
Harrison went down there and passed out leaflets?
Yeah.
Harrison Schultz, as we know. Our Harrison, not the governor, first governor of the
second governor. So it even got a new building, the Federal Reserve.
Pretty fancy looking building. That's what they call the fascist style of architecture.
But that was in 1935 when it got that built at the same time?
It was planned in 1935, but it was built by 1937.
Yeah, that looks like a Nazi building to me.
Yeah. Long row of columns kind of building.
Yeah.
Mussolini.
Same thing you saw in Berlin.
Sounds like a mausoleum.
Yeah. Linnea, do the next couple ones.
The Banking Act 1933 established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation with deposit insurance limited to $2,500 per account holder. This actually revolutionized the banking system because of the guarantee that depositors now had from non-banking sources. Oh, I see. Deposits insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, DC, maximum insurance for each depositor is $5,000.
It's double the start.
He doubled it here.
We've got you covered.
Oh,
and then
that's right.
It was $250,000 per depositor.
Yeah, that's what it... They made it after the crash of 2008. They upped it from 100,000 to 250,000.
100 times more.
Yeah. There's so much more money in
circulation.
When I'm at work, 5 years ago, there used to be hundreds of billions of dollars on the reports I would look at. Now it's $1 trillion, $2 trillion. I can't believe, I used to write out when I was doing my analysis, I would write out, I'd take the, the totals from the reports and write them. Now it's impossible because there's so many digits.
Yeah.
In 5 years, it's crazy. I mean, it's just incredible.
I should write my fees.
And here's again, changes in the banking laws, Glass-Steagall. This is from the Banking Act of 33. Over time, the term Glass-Steagall came to be used most often to refer to four provisions of the 1933 Banking Act that separated commercial banking from investment banking. It required commercial banks to eliminate their securities affiliates. Remember in the 20s, the banks had their own security companies, and you'd walk into the bank and they try to sell you the securities. The law defined commercial banks as taking in deposits and making loans, and investment banks as underwriting stocks from corporations and dealing with securities. The act explained that commercial banks could not deal with securities, and investment banks could not own commercial banks or have close connections with them. With the exception of commercial banks being allowed to underwrite government-issued bonds, commercial banks could only have 10% of their income come from securities. And on the left is the Glass-Steagall Act being signed in 1933 by Roosevelt. And on the right is the Glass-Steagall Act ending by Clinton in 1999. So that's
we're all smiling over Clinton.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we're going to get rich, baby. We're going to get rich.
Yeah, get rid of this regulation. We don't need this.
Wow. Well, it's all gone away now, right? They can do it, whether they're commercial or investment, they can do anything.
I don't know, I haven't read the 9,009 lines of code of the latest banking law. Okay.
We'll have to ask Hillary if she's going to end this and restore Glass-Steagall.
Don, do the next one.
She might.
Gold standard. Executive Order 6102, changes in the law for the Gulf Stream. Executive Order 6102 required all persons to deliver on or before May 1st, 1933, all but a small amount of gold coin, gold bullion, and gold certificates owned by them to the Federal Reserve in exchange for $20.67, equivalent to $376.58 in 2014 per troy ounce of gold. Under the Trading Act with the Trading with the Enemy Act, rather, of 1917, as amended by the recently passed Emergency Banking Act. This is kind of.
So I'll get rid of the word "by." Skip the word "by."
Yeah. March 9th, 1933. Violation of the order was punishable by fine up to $10,000 per person, equivalent to $182,185 in 2014, or even up to 10 years in prison, or both. The order caused all gold coin production to cease and all 1933 minted coins to be destroyed. The stated reason for the order was that hard times had caused hoarding of gold, stalling economic growth, and making the Depression worse. The main rationale behind the order was actually to remove the constraint on the Federal Reserve, which prevented it from increasing the money supply during the Depression. If gold cannot be completely legally owned, then it can't be legally redeemed. If it can't be legally redeemed, then it cannot restrain the federal bank.
The central bank,
which I mean.
Not that it helped, you know.
Which would mean the Federal Reserve System.
Yeah.
Say central bank, right?
Central bank, yeah. That's the Federal Reserve System.
Yeah.
Not that the Federal Reserve System was creating any money, you realized. Mm-hmm. You know. But no more gold coins produced after 1933. That was it. All the gold had to come into the treasury.
Yeah.
We'll do the next one.
Yeah, 1934 Gold Reserve Act. The United States Gold Reserve Act of January the 30th, 1934, required all gold, and gold certificates held by the Federal Reserve be surrendered and vested in the sole title of the United States Department of the Treasury. Changed the nominal price of gold from $20.67 per troy ounce to $35. The Treasury saw the value of their gold holdings Yeah, should not change that. Gold holdings increased by $2.81 billion overnight. And the U.S. went off the gold standard domestically, but stayed on for international payments. You got a little news article over there. It looks like headline: dollar revalued at 59.06, gold but at 35. An ounce. Stabilization funds set out. Gold bullion, standard metal to be sold at $35, as well as pot to steady the dollar.
Well, this
$2,792,000,000, the profit.
This was a way to very quickly increase the money supply, because
now
gold was part of the money supply, and it was in the treasury.
35.
And they could issue gold certificates,
mm-hmm.
you know, that would circulate.
Mm-hmm.
But first, before they raised the price of the gold, they took it. They paid the lower price to everybody for the gold. That's what people
there was do. Something on the last slide that I didn't quite understand. It said that if you didn't turn it in, then it wasn't legal tender. Right, and it says if gold can't be legally owned, then it can't be legally redeemed. So if I hadn't turned in my gold, and then I wanted to sell it later at the price that the bank suddenly it wouldn't be legal for me to do that?
Not in the United States. You'd probably have to go overseas and try to sell it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Martin.
Okay. The SEC, is that the secretary? Oh, the SEC.
SEC, okay,
I'm with you.
This is
the SEC.
This is now securities. We're now talking about security law changes.
Oh, thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, changes in the law securities. Section 2. The SEC defines the uptick rule to control short selling, 1938. Banks cannot only create credit money out of thin air, but speculators can sell stock that doesn't exist.
This took me so long to understand, and I used to work for brokerage houses for years, and I couldn't understand short selling, because it's just like the money system. Things don't come out of thin air. And it's just taken me so long to understand short selling.
It
doesn't even exist. It's like creating money out of nothing.
When a person sells a stock short on the exchange, he is offering for sale a stock he doesn't own. In effect, he is increasing the amount of stock in the market. He does this to cause the market price to decrease. After the market price goes down, he can step in and buy the security cheaper than when he sold it. He then has the stock to give to the buyer along with his profit. Sell high, buy low in that order. I would call this corruption myself.
I know, but it's legal.
Wow.
Just like creating money out of thin air is legal.
The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission.
I was looking at you. I thought you knew this all along. I was looking at you. You were reading this thing off. Okay, anyway. Anyway, I thought you knew. I thought Martin knows a hell of a lot about this.
Well, actually, I thought I did know it, but I actually clearly didn't really fully understand it.
Yes.
I didn't understand the point about it being created out of thin air.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that you were actually selling a stock that didn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought I understood short selling, but I didn't. Yeah. Like until recently, I didn't understand money creation.
Exactly.
So the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission adopted the uptick rule for short selling in 1938. A short sale could be done only at a price higher than the stock's previous sale price, plus tick. By the mid-1980s and 90s, virtually all of these good regulations had been circumvented by the nation's exchanges. Trading in index futures got around the short sale regulations because they can be sold in quantity without upticks and without borrowing stock. That's Stevens Olinger Law Science and Money, page 562. The SEC eliminated the uptick rule on July the 6th, 2007. And guess what happened the following year?
Yes!
That's ridiculous.
Yes!
Where? Where's the following year?
The fall of that year. The crisis started.
Yeah, the crash of 2008.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, the...
It's too complicated. I don't even know this.
The piece about short selling that I'm a little fuzzy about is I always thought that if a speculator wanted to sell a stock he didn't own, he had to somehow have made an agreement with a broker to borrow a stock from the broker.
That's what I understood.
Yeah, yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even then, he's borrowing it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which means there's someone, whoever owns that stock or bought that stock originally, still thinks they have a stock. Right? They,
yeah.
So it is, and even in that case, it's still selling something you don't really have. You're creating more stock than was issued by that corporation.
Is it that the brokers are creating the stock? In the, like a fractional reserve system with stocks? Is it the broker that's actually selling more stocks than they actually have? Is it the broker that's doing that?
I think they had to go and find them. Well, find real stocks that somebody.
I mean, it's whoever is going into the market and selling whatever they're either borrowing from a broker or they don't have. And they do have naked shorts. When you hear the term naked shorts, that's where the speculator's going in to sell a stock in the market and he hasn't borrowed it from a broker. That's called a naked short. And I think that might be illegal. I'm going to check on that. So, if you've borrowed it from a broker, then it's not a naked short. Then it's a legal selling short. But still, you're creating stock because you borrowed it from the broker, but that stock belongs to somebody else.
Yeah.
The person hasn't mm-hmm. given up their stock.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
So, but who's doing that? The broker or the company, corporation?
I think the speculators, the people who are going, trying to buy and sell stock.
So if they borrow it, it's just the same, it's an existing piece of money. I mean, an existing piece of value.
Yeah. Right, but the person who owns that borrowed stock doesn't have, where's his stock?
He's holding it.
But then there's two. There's the one he's holding, the original investment. And the other one's being sold.
Then he's not borrowing it.
He's saving it. But the original person doesn't know that. Right? You're doubling stocks, right? Unless I'm not understanding the term borrowing.
The word borrowing means he gets the stock and the other guy doesn't have it until he's finished with his deal.
Well, this is the system they have.
Which one?
No, he wasn't asking you a question. He was telling you something. He's saying that. So you're saying that whatever money is created from that borrowed stock goes to the speculator, and then that stock goes back to the person that lent it.
Yeah.
Oh, I got you.
No, the stock's been given to the guy who bought it.
Yeah.
So he's saying that the borrowed stock is only borrowed until that transaction is completed, and then whatever profit it turns goes to the speculator, and then that borrowed stock returns back mm-hmm. to the person from whom it was lent. But you're saying that it's not just the whatever profit was created from that stock in and of itself is going to a new entity without the original loaney knowing
about it. Right. You're going in, as a speculator, you're going into the market to sell it to somebody else. They expect to get it. Now, you, as the speculator, figure if you do that enough, do short sales enough, the price will go down and people will sell mm-hmm. and you'll buy it. And then you'll be able to deliver it to the first guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what happens is
Why would you want the stock price to fall so then you can buy them all up and deliver it to who?
Deliver it to the first people that you sold it to. Right? You went in and...
God, it's so weird. Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's a game where you can get the stock value to go down by dumping it someplace. Well, you got to do a lot of buying.
Wait,
of
is that what Martha things. Stewart? Is that what Martha Stewart did? Is that the reason that she went to jail?
What's Martha Stewart? I don't know. I don't know that story.
Oh. No.
No, it's not?
Oh. I don't think so.
Okay.
No, she was just insider trading.
Oh, that's right. It was just insider trading.
Yeah. This is gone. This whole thing, selling stock that doesn't exist. I mean, this whole system.
Yeah.
You know, financial
games.
Exchange
this. Games.
You know, they create money that doesn't exist, and they create stocks that don't exist.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's really nutty. Nutty world.
We're going to stop.
Changes in the world. Why don't we stop here? It's 5 o'clock.
That's good.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 4:04 here. That sounds good.
Yeah, the next thing is changes in the law, the gold standard. Oh, is that one? Or did I go the wrong way? Oh, we'll start here. Margin requirements, that one.
Slide 13.
Okay, so we'll start there.
Well, if we just do one more slide, we'll then be at section 3.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay. Linnea.
All right, changes in the law for securities. Margin requirements were raised. The Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System were given permanent power to regulate margin requirements in the Banking Act of 1935. Margin is borrowed money used to purchase securities. In the 1920s, investors commonly paid only 10% of the stock's price and borrowed the remaining 90%. The margin requirement was 10%. When the prices on the stock market began to go down and the value of the collateral therefore went down, the brokers or banks asked for more money from the investor, the margin call, but many investors did not have the money, so the banks or brokers sold their shares, causing further declines in the stock prices. This was one of the major causes of the stock market crash of 29. So now the Federal Reserve Bank margin requirements, percent of total value required to purchase stock, 34, it was 45%,
yeah,
and then it kind of fluctuates mildly until about 45, or it goes up to 75%, and then 46 was 100%.
Yeah.
They were messing around. And then at 40, then it went back down to half.
Yeah. Much better than 10% in the 20s.
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, you've got to wonder what the margin requirement is now.
Did you say it was 50?
I thought maybe it was, but that's a guess. I really don't know, because I don't buy stocks, and especially I wouldn't on margin. Or no, I don't have a margin account. You know. Okay, so we'll stop there. That's good.
Thank you all. Thank you, Sue.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well,